On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Let's face it, summer reading has become a fashion statement, a vacationer's fetish, a marketer's dream, sun lotion and Tuscan sun, whole families assiduously armed with hot paperbacks. Please, Oprah, please put my book on the beach. And yet, when the marketing din has gone by and the afternoons are long and there's a beach or a breeze or a porch swing, how many of us long to get lost in the middle of a great book or a pot boiler and feel the summertime slow to the soft turn of pages? Up next on Point, great readers on Great Summer Reads 2007. With us for our big summer book tour today from San Francisco, Oscar Villalón, book editor for the San Francisco Chronicle. Oscar, great to have you back. Thanks for joining us.
Well, you're welcome, Tom.
From Kansas City, Missouri, we have Vivian Jennings, owner of Rainy Day Books, an independent bookstore in Fairway, Kansas. It's been going strong for 31 years now. Vivian Jennings, congratulations on that, and thank you for being with us.
Hello, Tom. Glad to be here.
And from New York, Liesl Schillinger is with us. She's a regular contributor to the New York Times Book Review, a columnist for the paper's style section, and we've always enjoyed talking with her about books. Liesl Schillinger, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Let's get in mind first criteria. When you look for a great summer book, before we dive into your lists, and we will, and they're at our website, onpointradio.org, but Oscar, just start here. What do you look for in a great summer book, and is it different from a great, I don't know, winter book or any other season?
Well, I wouldn't say it's that different from a great winter book, but I think maybe one thing I look for is something that, I don't know, may accentuate what's going on in the summer in terms of maybe, you know, the weather or the particular, you know, sense of freedom. Kids are out running around and it seems as if though you have more leisure time, even though you probably don't.
But we like to think dream so, yeah.
Right. And, you know, for me, I usually like to tap into books that maybe have some sort of element of escapism to it, or if not escapism, that maybe have a certain, shall we say, wistfulness or maybe wallop to them that, you know, that after I finish reading it, being able to step outside and enjoy the gorgeous sunshine helps, you know, take the sting off a little bit.
Yeah, we won't hold you strictly to that, but we see your starting point. Vivian Jennings in Kansas City, how about you? What do you look for in a summer recommendation?
Well, I kind of agree with Oscar in that I think that people are looking for things that can sort of take them away. It's like a little mini vacation for your mind. Maybe you can't really go away, but you decide you can in a book.
Read away.
It's a sort of escape. It's like they can go to the past in nonfiction or fiction, or they can go someplace they've never been before. But it's just things that intrigue them, sort of take them away. And I think it's just the spirit of vacation because it is more of a leisure time in our minds anyway.
And Liesl Schillinger, I don't know how you choose yours, but you wrote a great story some years back about what you saw in your scientific survey of readers on the beach, the types here, there, and everywhere, and who reads what. Take us back to that.
Well, in New York City, we're all by the ocean, and there's this exodus every weekend to lakes and to the Hamptons or to Fire Island or upstate.
Oh, yeah.
Some of us even fly away. And something I wrote about in that essay is I looked on the various beaches where I went on the weekends and tried to figure out who was reading what, depending on what beach it was and where
right.
in the beach.
Right.
And I found that the closer you got to the snack shack,
yeah.
the more likely people were to be reading, you know, Judy Blume's Summer Sisters or like Dean Koontz or something kind of
right.
fun and thriller-like.
But near, if you got near the really Pringles and the Popsicles.
Yeah, I mean, you know, someone told me, okay. you know, I don't bring a book out because it's a book to read on the beach. I bring it a book out because it's a book I love. And I think in summer, people want to feel indulgent about themselves and to remember the experience of reading they had when they were kids and the days in the summer didn't have hours and they just lost themselves in books. And so I think for summer, when we go out there, we're kind of pledging ourselves back into that pleasurable experience of reading.
You found Dean Koontz by the snack shack. What did you find in the middle distance, and what about the far dune?
Well, in the middle distance, this is a few years back, people were reading Barbarians in the Hedgerows, which is about rich people buying houses in the Hamptons. I basically said that the people in the mid-beach were like cocktail readers. They were looking for books they could talk about over cocktails that night.
Okay, yeah.
And far away, people were reading books in French. You know, like there is, they're like intellectual things, like a book by Marguerite Duras that was like, I don't know, I think it said, irritated and at the same time seduced by propaganda posters and by their reading of Pierre Loti, the two of them succumbed to the colonial adventure.
Oh,
these
the
are very
sorrow,
pale
the
people.
Yeah.
You the
found
people
you found Ayn
well.
Rand out there in the far dune.
I found Ayn Rand. That's true. That's true.
Okay.
But as the summer lengthens, though, you find the intellectual readers sneakily reading the thrillers and the,
right.
the thriller people picking up some more meat, you know.
Right. It's wonderful. Wonderful. How wherever you sit on the beach and wherever you're reading, we want to help you do it in style this summer and with some real satisfaction. Oscar, begin to take us into your list if you'd be good enough. What are you recommending to folks this summer?
Well, I'm recommending a bunch of things, but let's start off one first with Haruki Murakami's latest novel, After Dark.
Mm.
I first of all would recommend anything that Murakami has written, and when we're talking about Liesl was referring to as, you know, indulgent reading, this definitely would count. All his other works. This one in particular, it's a slim novel compared to some of his other ones. Basically about three or four people whose lives cross one night in Tokyo, and the whole novel set over the span of about 7 hours, just a little before midnight and a little before 7 in the morning.
Haruki Murakami, and magical realism is his thing. Does he bring it back here in those 7 hours in Tokyo?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily call it magical realism as we may know it in terms of South American writers, but he definitely brings all these elements of the fantastic, even the mystical, into the story.
And why this one for this summer?
Because summer is when you can stay up from midnight till 7. And usually the consequences aren't as bad as it would be, say, well, you know, maybe something right. in the dead of November.
Right. Oscar, read a little bit from it if you can, if you've got a little passage from Haruki Murakami's After Dark.
Sure thing. Let me just set this up.
Yeah.
In this particular scene, one of the protagonists, a young student named Mari, she's washing up in the bathroom of a bar called the Skylark. And it's about, okay. at this point in the novel, it's about 2 a.m. She straightens her bangs and rearranges the hood of the parka under her varsity jacket. Then, as if urging herself on, she bites her lip and nods at herself several times. The Mari in the mirror also bites her lip and nods several times. She hangs the bag on her shoulder and walks out of the restroom. The door closes. Our viewpoint camera lingers in here for a while, observing the restroom. Mari is no longer here. Neither is anyone else. Music continues to play from the ceiling speaker. A Hall & Oates song now. I can't go for that. A closer look reveals that Mari's image is still reflected in the mirror over the sink. The Mari in the mirror is looking from her side into this side. Her somber gaze seems to be expecting some kind of occurrence, but there's no one on this side. Only her image is left in the Skylark's restroom mirror. The room begins to darken. And the deepening darkness, I can't go for that, continues to play.
I can't go for that, but we've got our viewpoint camera with Haruki Murakami and After Dark there in Tokyo. You get us started, Oscar. Thank you. Vivian, what about the top of your list? What have you got suggested there?
Well, I'd like to suggest a novel called Brothers. It's a new novel by Da Qin in paperback. So it's a great – a lot of times people like paperbacks because they can travel more handily with them or take them to the pool and don't worry so much about getting them wet.
And this is a Chinese author. So we've gone from Japan to China here.
Exactly. And Da was actually grew up during the Cultural Revolution in China. And this is sort of a Cain and Abel story in China, set in China. And it's the height of China's Cultural Revolution. And it's about two boys. One is illegitimate son of a powerful general, and his name is Shinto. And then he was born to the general's mistress, who threw herself off a cliff, by the way, only moments after delivering her child.
Oh, geez.
And then Tan is the other son, who was born into a life of comfort and luxury. And they grow up remaining ignorant of each other's existence, but then through divergent roads, they become driven in different paths, and then they fall in love with the same woman unknowingly and move towards a very explosive moment. And it includes the Tiananmen Square situation. It's a wonderful way to understand some of the history of China. There's assassinations and love affairs and missed opportunities, and it's got it's got a great feel, and because he knows this so well, I think that it really comes alive for you. And it's also an homage to his late father, who endured a lot and suffered a lot during the Cultural Revolution in China. Da Qian has an amazing spirit. I've met him. We've hosted him, by the way. And he has just such an amazing spirit, having gone through all this.
A giant sweep there, all the way from Cultural Revolution to Tiananmen Square. It's got and one brother a general and the other, what, a dissident. It's got sort of the Dr. Zhivago structure to it there. Hold that thought. We'll hear more about it. But Liesl, I want to get a top pick from you. What have you got at the top of your list?
Well, one that everyone is going to be talking about and already is The Savage Detectives, which is by the great Chilean-born writer Roberto Bolaño, who died a few years ago at 50. And it's a really original voice. It's a 17-year-old boy who's going to college in Mexico, but really all he's thinking about is girls, kind of. But
The
he's
Savage
going to college.
Detectives? Okay.
The Savage Detectives. Yeah. I'm afraid I don't know the Spanish title.
That's all
this
right.
This has been translated so quickly, which is a sign of how loved this book
this
is.
This is like lots of sex and coming of age and what? Is this for
and
young men? They're going to love this?
Intellectual pretense. Mm-hmm. It's basically all of these very self-serious university people who call themselves visceral realists.
Mm. Read something for us. What have you got?
And it's set in Mexico. The author was from Chile. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so it's a funny book. It's wry. This kid begins, "I've been cordially invited to join the visceral realists. I accepted, of course. There was no initiation ceremony. It was better that way. I'm not really sure what visceral realism is. I'm 17 years old. My name is Juan Garcia Madero, and I'm in my first semester of law school. I wanted to study literature, not law, but my uncle insisted, and in the end, I gave in. I'm an orphan, and someday I'll be a lawyer. That's what I told my aunt and uncle, and then I shut myself in my room and cried all night." And it parts from this to show him going into this group of incredibly touchy, pretentious men who are discussing poetry, and he offends them by knowing more about poetry than they do. But then it just turns into, like you were saying earlier, I mean, it almost has the brio of "Y tu mamá también" or something, but instead of your mamá, it's... well, some hot poetry chicks, but also it's, you know, the whole breathtaking mood of adolescent aspiration, all these kids who have such a poetic and literary vision for themselves.
I love
it. It's a fun book, and everyone will be talking about it.
Liesl, go on down your list and give us a little capsule summary. We'll come back to some of them. And I should say, all three, Vivian, Liesl, Oscar, their picks are at our website, onpointradio.org. But give us a little capsule summary on down your list, if you would, Liesl, so we can chew on what you've got there.
Okay. A book that really astonished me is called A Good and Happy Child, and it's a suspense novel. It's by Justin Evans, and it's really in the tradition of Ira Levin, you know, like Rosemary's Baby or
Ooh,
something.
Ooh, that creeped me out years and years and years ago, yeah.
Well, this can creep you out now. it's about a young father in New York who is uneasy with fatherhood, and through his therapy sessions that his wife sends him into because he's so frightened by parenting, we learn just why he might be afraid. And it's really chilling and beautifully written. And then a fun book that I really got a kick out of is a satire by Christopher Buckley, who wrote Thank You for Smoking. And this is called Boomsday, a novel. And in it, there's this young Washington wonkette named Cassandra Devine, yeah, who comes up with this modest proposal to save Social Security by convincing 70-year-olds to kill themselves for a huge tax write-off for their heirs,
right,
and also urges young people to quit paying taxes until this is addressed.
So is it funny or horror or gross or what?
It's
got to be funny
if
it's Christopher Buckley.
Complete spoof. I mean, yeah, it's farce. It's yeah, really funny. You know, kids start storming gated communities and vandalizing golf courses. And it's just, it will be a treat on the beach or on the jitney.
Can you read a little bit from that one for us, Liesl? Have you got something from Boomtown?
I can. It's written in a kind of Y-in way, which means that, you know, it's not full of rhapsodic lyrical passages. They're
yep,
funny lines, but I put some together for
okay,
you. Here is Cassandra addressing the American public on national television.
Okay.
"I'm calling on every member of my generation to take their iPods out of their ears and send the U.S. government a message. Not a text message, either. It's simple. If the government can withhold our money, then we can withhold our money." The interviewer says, "By that you mean..." "A tax revolt, Brian. I'm calling on members of my generation to stop paying taxes." And then she's, of course, arrested and as youth riot across the nation. And then she says again, I guess to the person she works for, "Solidarity's revolt began in a Gdansk shipyard. This one seems to be teeing off from a golf course." So
and down
this is
they
just...
Go.
It's fun.
Christopher Buckley in Boomtown. Vivian.
Boomsday.
Excuse me. Vivian, there's a revolution imagined in humor. You've got a reading from the Da Qian book, Brothers, you might share with us to take us back into a sort of a more real revolution.
Well, this is from Brothers, and here's a passage from it. My father often said that no matter the intention and endeavor, one is given to the whimsy of fate, that we humans are the petty pawns of a mammoth cosmic game unseen to living earthly mortals, that the path of one's life, though seemingly random and curvy as a river, is a chosen one, predestined not by you, but by some unknowable divinity. Each day a mere step in the beguiling game of chess, rendered on a befuddling chessboard at the mercy of a knowing deity. Each event an unpredictable move, an unforetelling of what lies beyond, though stealthily connected to other events in ways that elude our eyes and escape our senses. He would add that the gist of life is living fiercely and with rigor, unbending to the exertion of fate, unyielding to the scourge of destiny.
And there we're in the midst of Brothers and kind of a Chinese wisdom being delivered. Take us on down your list, Vivian, with some quick note of some others you've got there.
Well, I liked Washington Spies, The Story of America's First Spy Ring by Alexander Rose. And what he does is that he takes us to a time in the summer of 1778 when the war was poised to turn in his favor, and Washington, George Washington, desperately needed to know where the British would strike next. So he puts together this band of spies. It includes a Quaker and a sailor and a barkeep and a cavalryman from Yale and a friend of the doomed Nathan Hale and a peaceful, sickly farmer. And they form the Culper Ring, actually. And so it's really amazing.
Is this history, nonfiction, or an imagined?
This is nonfiction.
Wow.
And so it's got ciphers and dead drops and invisible ink. It's sort of Alan Furst with muskets.
And
but
Charles Frazier is back with 13 Moons. This, of course.
He is back, yes.
What do you make of it? Tell us about it.
You know, it's a very interesting book because it's about this young boy who's an orphan, is sent to an outpost near the Indian Nation, and there's two Indian chiefs who sort of adopt him in very different ways, and the Civil War kind of comes into it a little bit again, but it's about the Cherokee, and it's funny, though. I think that people will be surprised at the humor in it because there's one chief is a very funny man, and so there's quite a bit of humor in it, which I think people may or may not be expecting in Frazier, but there is. And then there's a book called The Whistling Season by Ivan Doig, and I thought it was really fun because it starts out and there's an ad, a newspaper ad, offering the services of this woman. It says, can't cook but doesn't bite. An A1 housekeeper, sound morals and exceptional disposition. And so there's this widower in the fall of 1909 in Montana, and the ever-whistling Rose Llewellyn and her font of knowledge brother, Morris, they come to this place in Montana with a stampede of homesteaders, and the schoolmarm runs away with an itinerant preacher, so Morris is pressed into service in the one-room schoolhouse and ends up with very interesting education, none of them the textbook variety.
You've got me at very interesting there. Oscar Villalón, take us on down your list. You've got... Well, there's lots of places to jump in. I'm staring at it. It's a great little list. Give us more.
We're all over the place. I have Armistead Maupin's new book, Michael Tolliver Lives.
He's back after all these years?
Back after all these years, after Tales of the City, more Tales of the City,
right.
Further Tales of the City. We thought he was tapped out. Thank God he's not.
What's he doing in the new book? He's bringing back a character from Tales of the City?
Michael Tolliver, otherwise known as Mouse. We catch up with him about, it's like 20 years later. He's still living in the city. God bless him, he owns a home in San Francisco, which in itself is a major accomplishment.
and we're right back in the middle of San Francisco gay life here. I mean,
and just life in general, which is what Maupin does so well, and it did so well with all his other books. I mean, he makes our city, magical in a way that Herb Cain did with his column in the Chronicle for all those years.
Is the older Michael Tolliver happy or not?
Well, he's as happy as he's going to be. I mean, he's married. His husband, Ben, is about 20 years younger. He is HIV positive, but he survived, and, through the help of the new drug cocktails, that's keeping him going. He still maintains his close relationship with Brian Hawkins, who people remember him as the womanizer that they were both both Two Peas in a Pod back in 28 Barbary Lane.
Right.
And he still, you know, gets advice and hangs out with Mrs. Madrigal.
And then you've got a couple of others, new and old, on your list. Ian McEwan's new book on Chesil Beach, and also Jack
yes.
Kerouac, The Dharma Bums, both make your list. Tell us why.
Well, for you know, basically the same reason, but for they're both, I think, beautiful books. But on Chesil Beach, you know, this is McEwan's new one. It's a slender book. It's almost a novella. But I'll tell you what, it's, in my opinion, it's a masterpiece of modern English literature. It's a stunning book about a wedding night that goes terribly wrong in July of 1962 in England on Chesil Beach.
A kind of sexual innocence or ignorance.
Exactly. Well, you know, two people who love each other, who are incredibly young, who have the misfortune of being married, you know, before the sexual revolution. You know, as he points out in the book, you know, think about it, and merely in about, you know, 6 years, what a different world it's going to be from 1962 to 1968, how they would have perhaps expressed themselves or expressed their desires and these sort of things. It really is a culmination of all his work, which more or less meditates on the same theme, which is the blown opportunities for love and you know, the grotesque consequences. Here, the consequences aren't nearly as grotesque in his other works. That's to say, people don't die.
Mm-hmm.
But it becomes a page-turner. It's absolutely gripping to see whether these two people can right the cart, so to speak, and survive their own, well, basically their own ignorance.
And Jack Kerouac's Dharma Bums, I think it's 50 this year. I read it again not so many years ago and really loved it. You've got it back on your list.
Well, it's the 50th anniversary this year of On the Road, and so you can expect, like, somewhere in the fall you're going to be, you know, deluged with pieces
right,
about
that's
about
it.
Kerouac
yeah.
and this
yeah.
sort of thing. But what I love about Dharma Bums, though, is that in this, you know, relating to the theme of summer books, it has that this joy to it. This
figuring out Buddhism in the hills of California.
Oh, in the Sierra Nevadas, in the mountains, communing with nature, getting drunk on jugs of wine, you know. It's an autobiographical novel, basically. You know, his character is Ray, but the other character, Jaffe, that's Gary Snyder. And their time together, you know, in Berkeley, you know, hanging out too with, you know, with Allen Ginsberg and, you know, several other Bay Area poets who all figure in this. And, you know, and the thing about this book, I should point out, is that it kind of reminds me of the Hemingway line about Dostoevsky. Mm. How could someone who writes so badly write so well?
Right.
And that's the case here too with Kerouac. Kerouac, maybe because of the how enormous his heart was and how his perhaps even naive honesty and just how he just poured everything out on the page really grips you, and particularly in this book. And the
freshness of it, the freshness just carried me away again. I felt like I was in the dawn of the world again somehow.
Yes, but I would like to say this. One warning, though, to people who read this book, please do not try to write like this. It pretty much, Kerouac was the only guy who could pull this off and barely did so.
Right.
I highly recommend that you just admire but not imitate.
Read it. Oscar, Liesl, Vivian, please stand by. Let's begin to bring our listeners in here from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Chuck is on the line. Hi, Chuck. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Outstanding program.
Thank you.
The book I'd like to recommend, I just finished it a few weeks ago, is a book called Exile by Richard North Patterson.
What's it about? What is it?
Yeah, full of intrigue. It's about the Middle East. Without giving away too much, it's about the Prime Minister who visits the Bay Area, San Francisco area, and is assassinated. And
It's a spy thriller then, Chuck? Or
exactly. But Richard North Patterson does a wonderful job of describing and depicting and documenting the Middle East problems between Israel and Palestine, and he remains very neutral, so he doesn't take one side or another, but of course elucidates the entire problem, but interwoves it with a suspense type novel, a young lady that goes on trial for the attempted assassination of the premier of Israel. So it's just an incredibly well-written book.
We've got it, Exile by Richard North Patterson. Thanks for calling, Chuck. Let's get another call from Marshfield, Massachusetts. Lisa, you're on the air.
Hi. Liesl had mentioned a unique voice and beautiful writing. The novel Charity Girl really has both.
I don't know it. Who wrote it?
It's written by a Boston author named Michael Lowenthal, and he's actually a professor of creative writing at Lesley.
Okay.
And it's a historical novel set in World War II about a little-known phenomenon where girls or young ladies with venereal disease were actually quarantined to keep them away from soldiers who were on leave in Boston. It's very delicately dealt with, and it's not disturbing, although it is frightening that their lives just sort of were put on hold for a period of time.
And what made you love it? Did it take you to that time? It gave you new empathy? What was it exactly, Lisa?
Absolutely. You know, I moved here when I was young, when I was in my early 20s to Boston, and the protagonist, I guess for myself, it was a parallel. Her name is Freda, and she works at Jordan Marsh, and she's 21, and her life is, you know, very, very happy, well-balanced, everything's great, until she has one unfortunate evening with a soldier she actually falls in love with, but she does get venereal disease, and then her whole life basically is not her own anymore, and she's quarantined. And at that time, they had taken many schools and different farms and just basically treated these ladies nicely, but they were quarantined, and they were treated for, you know, the disease.
And there's the magic of some good books, the way life turns in an instant or on one night. And we hear it, Charity Girl by Michael Lowenthal. Let's get one more call before the break here from Charleston, South Carolina. William, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Certainly. What do you know?
Well, I guess I'm a little bit of a counterpoint here. I went to my bookshelf and pulled off all the old paperbacks I have, which I was told to keep, by the way, by a professor many, many, many years ago.
Was he a wise man?
He was a very wise. He was a Yaley. He was a very wise man. He said, keep every paperback you ever buy, and I have, so I have hundreds of these things. But I went over and just pulled out a swath of these things, and, you know, I got Melville, I got Hemingway, I've got Pudd'nhead Wilson by Twain, I've got Jaws, I've got Oliver Twist, 1984, on and on. I've got Dostoevsky, by the way. I've got Raw Youth here.
So you're back in Moby Dick territory, an Old Man in the Sea, and all that
right.
good stuff.
So I would think if you're going to read on the beach, I would recommend either Moby Dick, On the Beach, obviously,
of course.
Old Man in the Sea, or maybe even Jaws.
Hey, have it classic and old, or Jaws and ready for Hollywood. William, thanks for that. Liesl, what about it? New or old or both? How do you mix up your beach bag?
Well, I have a book club, and so I tend to be reading what I have to read for my beach book club.
Yes, the discipline of the club.
I know. So we just read a book called Plenty that I really recommend. It's by Alisa Smith and J.P. McKinnon. It's about I think they're now married, husband and wife in Vancouver, who decided to eat nothing for a year but what grew within 100 miles of Vancouver. And they get so angry at each other because they're carb-deprived. They lose their minds. They practically starve to death. But it's told, you know, month by month, and it's memoirs-infused. So we just read that for book club.
Vivian, I think you've got another little reading for us from something called Gone with the Windsors. Tell us about it and let us hear some.
This is such a fun book. It came out in paperback yesterday, and it's called Gone with the Windsors, a wicked comedy about the romance of the century by Lori Graham. And what she does is that she introduces you to Maybelle Brumdy, who is frisky, wealthy, and recently widowed.
Woo-hoo.
And she leaves Baltimore and arrives in London to find her old school chum, Bessie Wallace Warfield, who is there ahead of her. And guess what? Wallace is on the make, hampered by plotting husband number two, but armed with terrific bone structure and a few erotic tricks.
I think we've heard of her.
Up in China.
Right. Whoa.
Wallace sets her sights on the most eligible bachelor in the world, the Prince of Wales,
right.
heir to the throne.
Oh,
and so Maybelle keeps track of Wallace's stalking HRH, as they call him, His Royal Highness, her stalking him through the romantic process and landing him. And she has such a fun sense. But it's all based on real history. So these diary entries go by date, and the real history and the real thing is in there. But here is a little passage from it. This is 2nd of April, 1939. Mr. Chamberlain has put his foot down. If Hitler makes the slightest move, Britain will go to Poland's aid. All very well, but if, as people like Winnie Gulliver believe, he has his eye on half a dozen other territories too, then what? One can't rush around the world helping every little country out of difficulties. Wally has had the idea of HRH making a broadcast to the American people. As she says, if Britain gets into another war, before too long she'll be looking to America for assistance. So the American public must be made to stop and think. They are the ones who'll be asked to pay the price after all. And who better to make them think than a British prince with an American wife? HRH is very keen and has Dudley Forward looking into it. And then she says,
you've got us into foreign policy there. We wanted exotic Chinese sex tricks.
And then she says, the 5th of September, 1937, today's subject has been HRH's banishment. Wallace, as much as she adores Paris, England is where they really belong. She said, it's a terrible waste of a king. David knows everything there is to know about running the country. He was trained for it, unlike Bertie York. He should be asked back and given something useful to do. Humphrey Butler said, the problem with that, Wally, is that no new king wants to have an ex-king watching over his shoulder. Wally said, well, we'll have to be given something to do. I can't have him under my feet for the next 30 years.
And this is a would-be king who will be no king at all, of course, in history because of his relationship with Wallace. And
exactly.
Imagine there in fiction. That's wonderful.
Exactly.
Liesl, take us into a couple more of yours. You've got the upper class. Tell us about that. And free food for millionaires. What have you got?
Well, the upper class sounds like a little like Vivian's pick in that it is such guilty fun. You're going to feel guilty, you know, embarrassed maybe reading a book that shows a lush-lipped girl with her fingers in her mouth on the cover that says The Upper Class, a novel. but it is tremendously fun. It's about life at a Hotchkiss-like private boarding school called Wellington.
Okay.
And it was written by three Hotchkiss grads, Hobson Brown, Taylor Materne, and Carolyn Says.
Mm.
And it's basically about two very improbable roommates who arrive at the school. And one of them is a New England blue blood, a blonde, blue-eyed girl who's very shy named Lane Hunt. And the other is this nouveau riche Long Island Lolita whose stepmother has a rhinestone shirt that says spoiled as they step out onto the greens of Wellington, where they horrify
Hello,
everyone
Paris
they
Hilton.
See.
Mm.
Yeah, well, Italian style. But it's just the writing surprised me by being really sensitive. I guess I won't read it now just to save time, or I will if you
well,
like.
Well, blue blood kind of Hogwarts here, as you describe. Have you got something from
yeah,
it?
Sure. It's kind of like Harry Potter in a way, because these kids go into the different boarding houses and there are different social cliques that they're desperate to get into, but there isn't a magic sorting hat. You know, they have to fend for themselves.
Right.
And there's a touching little line in the story where as the kids arrive, whether they're, you know, from well-known families or from the Midwest or from the inner city, they've all arrived at this place of privilege. And they're all sitting there as their parents going. And they're thinking, now they all know what family was. It was feeling the vibration of the garage door as the early parent left and you still dozed in bed. It was the taste of milk from the carton. It was knowing that the toys you would never ever play with again were in a box in the dark basement, a box with your name on it, your box. So that's kind of touching.
Yeah.
But as it begins, Lane Hunt, the blonde, starchy protagonist, is at a country club with her stepfather and her mother, and she's just thinking about everything she's leaving behind, and she thinks of all the parties in the country club, and she says, it was one party, gardenias and buttonholes and gin and tonics and tiki torches. It was one night, three sisters and neon Lily Pulitzer under a fiery moonrise. It was even one face, the face of the community, a composite of concerned and affectionate and freckled and tan and handsome and aristocratic and wise and wrinkled features. It was her upbringing. And there's a real fascination with preppiness. This is something I've written about recently in the culture right now. I don't know whether people are looking for stability or security or this American tradition, but this book is fun, and it's the first of a three-book series, and I think they're even planning a fourth, and it may turn into a movie. Another
Lush
book,
Lip, The Upper Class there by Hobson Brown and Taylor Materne and Carolyn Say.
Exactly.
Then you've got Min Jin Lee, the opposite of
prepping. A book that reminds me of your caller Lisa from Boston was talking about a girl who had her life changed in one night, and that happens to the protagonist of Min Jin Lee's novel. Free Food for Millionaires is a sprawling kind of 19th century novel, only set in the late 90s, about this Korean-American girl who's graduated from Princeton and has parents who have huge expectations for her. And when she graduates and comes home for dinner in Queens, her parents work at a laundry, and tells them she's not going to go to law school. She wants to find herself. You know, they kick her out. And so it ends up just being I really like the novel because it had such good plotting. It's her friends. It's her life. It reveals a Korean-American experience that I'd been unaware of. But it also deals with the kind of post-collegiate coming of age that other novels like to do, but this has a lot that's new to say.
Free Food for Millionaires by Min Jin Lee. Great title. Let's go to a few of our listeners. Lots of callers here. Jason from Peabody, Massachusetts. You're on the air, my friend.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have two books I'd like to recommend. The first, Mark Twain's The Innocents Abroad. It's just an incredibly funny look at Americans traveling as he cruises through the Mediterranean, making fun of every ethnic and nationality, but with a very lighthearted and good-humored type of way.
And how does that read in 2007, where we're abroad in such kind of torturous ways sometimes, Jason?
I think it makes us nostalgic for a day when Americans could be the loud Americans without being maybe what we're viewed of as today.
Yeah, yeah. And what else have you got?
V.S. Naipaul's A Bend in the River,
yeah.
About a small town in an unnamed country in Central Africa, where he goes to open up a kind of a multi-parts import store. But just a very good look at life at the time of a very tumultuous time in Central Africa. I grew up in Africa, and so it was just a very, very good characterization of mentality and experience there.
Oh, I love it. Naipaul, V.S. Naipaul can always sweep me away for the summer. Jason, thanks for those. Let's get a call from Williamsburg, Virginia. Anita, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I'm visiting actually on the East Coast from Santa Rosa, California, and I've run into some great books. I order my books from a small press distribution who handles all these little presses that you don't see many of these books around. And my book that I just read was called Goodbye Serbia, and it's a combination of a mystery, a thriller, and a really sexy romantic kind of war story that I really like.
Who wrote it, Anita? Do you have it there? Do you recall?
I forgot who wrote it.
Goodbye, Serbia.
All of the writers that I've been reading here this summer are from Eastern Europe, and they're great. They're totally different, but this place called Small Press Distribution, I order them online, and they carry these books from all of these different places. But this one, Goodbye, Serbia, it's about a young freelance woman journalist who meets a man on a train in Eastern Europe. She's going over there to get a story, and he gets thrown off the train, and she finds out that he's a war criminal. But somehow, once she gets to places she's going, she keeps running into this man, and then this romance starts.
You've got me intrigued. Thrown off a train, thriller, sexy love story, and mystery around every corner. Goodbye, Serbia.
And another one that I found, I think it's by the same publisher, but I don't know by the same author. It's a really funny political, a political satire. And it's called, I'm trying to think of the name. Oh, it's called A Trilogy in Paradoxism.
A Trilogy in Paradoxism. Okay, you've got us in real exotica there, and we love it. We've got so much to get to, but Anita, thanks for that. Vivian, you've got Khaled Hosseini back on your list with 1,000 Splendid Sons. There were so many Kite Runner readers out there. Talk about book clubs. That must have been one of the biggest ones ever. What do you make of his new book?
You know what? I have to say to people, if they liked The Kite Runner, they will love 1,000 Splendid Sons because it is even better.
Back in Afghanistan again.
Back in Afghanistan, you get the story set against the events of Afghanistan's last 30 years, from the Soviet invasion to the reign of the Taliban to post-Taliban rebuilding, actually. But this time it's a tale of two generations of women, and it's just really amazingly done. It's a very deeply moving account of family and friendship set against this just volatile situation. Time after time, the political turmoil and the position of women in Afghanistan over these periods of time. But I think this is going to be another classic. I really do.
So worth coming back to the Kite Runner, man. There, I can see the clock ticking, and I want to get to these. Oscar, you've got Dancing to Almendra on your list. I don't know this one. Tell us about it. Matira Montero?
Mayra Montero.
Thank you. Mayra Montero.
Yeah, Mayra Montero. She's a Cuban-born, but then left Cuba, Puerto Rico, and has made Puerto Rico her home now for ages. And I think she has a column down there, one of the major newspapers in San Juan. Mayra, she's been writing for a while now, these really exquisite, exquisite slender novels, beautiful novels, on a variety of things, from voodoo to adultery, infidelity, these sort of different things. And her last book was Captain of the Sleepers, a wonderful book about the history behind Vieques and the bombing down there and the sort of the long tumult between the U.S. and Puerto Rico. This one, Dancing to Almendra, it's more of a genre book, and it's set in the late 50s in Havana, And it basically involves a young reporter, this guy named Joaquin Porrata. And Joaquin was working for one of the, you know, one of many of the newspapers that, that were around in Havana then, and is investigating the shooting death of a hippo.
As in hippopotamus. And this is back
hippopotamus
in kind of mafia-dominated Havana. Mafia is a big theme here.
Absolutely. And the thing is that the slaying of the hippo has something to do with the murder of Humberto Anastasia up in New York. And so as he digs, and as, of course, people tell him in a good noir sort of way,
yes.
I mean, as any good noir would have it, people tell him, stop digging.
Right.
He unveils more and more layers of corruption, not only in Cuban society, but among his family, among his friends. Mm. I think it's a good book for people to be introduced to Montero's work. I think they enjoy it, particularly with all the elements of crime and the real-life characters that figure in Meyer Lansky, George Raft, all these other sort of people. And, you know, it's got everything you would probably want and that sort of thing, you know, vice and glamour, you know, that sort of thing. And again, what it does, too, as it does with all her other works, it shows how long the societies of the U.S., and the Americas have been intertwined. They've basically been mingling with each other, you know, forever. But it's just something that in the U.S. we're more blind to than they are in Latin America.
Dancing to Almendra by
Almendra, which is Almendra. Spanish for almond, but it's a sort of a particular dance.
Myra Montero. Let's go to Michelle in Boston. Michelle, you're on the air. What have you got?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have a great summer read for everybody. It's called The Lost Diary of Don Juan.
Okay.
By Douglas Carlton Abrams. And it's not quite what you would expect. First of all, it's written so well, you just feel like you've really escaped.
Contemporary or back in Don Juan's time?
It is historical, in Don Juan's time, 16th century Sevilla, Spain.
Yeah.
It's written so well, you feel as if you are there. I mean, you can feel the cobblestones under your feet. You can, you know...
Never mind cobblestones under your feet. This is Don Juan. How's the steam factor?
It is up there a little bit. And it's great. It has adventure, intrigue, sword fights, lovemaking, great characters. My husband, I actually made my husband read the book, and he really liked it.
Hey, that's great.
It's a book for either men or women. Just is a fabulous book.
We love it. The Lost Diary of Don Juan. And Michelle, our clock is running down. We love it. We appreciate that suggestion as well. Liesl, you've got another one here around love, The Master Bedroom by Tessa Hadley. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, I actually have decided it'd be unfair of me to go into it because it doesn't come out until August, but look for her. She's a wonderful British writer, Tessa Hadley, and she has two volumes coming out in August, one of short stories called Sunstroke and this very charged romance in The Master Bedroom. I had wanted to mention as well, Then We Came to the End, the Joshua Ferris novel, which is a book I think that you'll be seeing on a lot of trains, planes, and automobiles this summer. It's like the television series The Office, but on paper. It's an American novel about Americans now. It's set in Chicago, and they're coping with life in the age of downsizing. And it's very engrossing, although it may remind you a little too much of work.
Maybe for the summer, there's no way we're going to get to the end of all these lists. But Vivian, you've got Michael Ondaatje's Divisadero on your list. Tell us about it. What do you make of it?
Well, everybody who liked The English Patient is going to really like Divisadero because it is the same beautiful writing that Ondaatje did in that. And it starts in the 1970s in Northern California, and it's near the Gold Rush country. And there's a father and his two daughters, one of whom is adopted, Anna and Claire, and they're working the farm with the help of this very interesting man, Coop, who is also a young man who makes her home with them. Sort of a makeshift family, but then there's an act of violence that sets fire to their lives and takes them from San Francisco to Nevada to France.
Wow, and off we go into the wild blue yonder. Michael Ondaatje, Divisadero there. We're out of time. There are more books on your list. Listeners, you can see them at onpointradio.org. It's really a splendid collection. It looks like it should be a great reading summer. I want to thank all three of you. Vivian Jennings at Rainy Day Books in Fairway, Kansas. Vivian, great to make your acquaintance, and thanks for being with us this hour.
Thanks for having me.
Oscar Villalone at the San Francisco Chronicle. Great to have you, my friend.
Oh, my pleasure, sir.
And Liesl Schillinger in New York. Liesl, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
Happy reading. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.